But he's not quite tame, and his nature is not totally describable. But one begins to sense, as one reads these stories, that nonetheless, the long-term precepts that span the ages are very serious indeed. And this is what goes along with the fact that humanity doesn't leave anything behind. We have learned something. We carry something with us. And these long-term precepts of what it is that makes life livable are very serious indeed. The children who undergo these adventures are more or less wise and good, depending upon how the long-term experience on Earth has been taught them in relevant maxims. Precepts and maxims might add to human character, but Aslan in Narnia also has a way of precipitating something novel and unpredictable. The animals and the children, too, have to be flexible, for the framework of history and the expected course of events have a way of not being dependable. And this is what, you know, that's what I say. You don't have to be in graduate school and learned to understand the kernel of Lewis's thinking, because it's in the Narnia books, and you can be a child and be formed by those books if you enter into them and they happen to you. But then that doesn't mean that that's where you stay, does it? You don't have to stay in that. That's, you carry that with you, but then you move on into the trilogies and into the trilogy and into his other great essays, in which you really learn more and more about how to pay attention and how to be alert. The children are clearly enough afraid of this new world while also being attracted to it. One begins to find how odd it is that we all are tempted to believe that the order in which we live is the best possible. It's very hard for all of us to feel that the way in which we live in the world isn't the, you know, that should be the normal for all the planets. What is our attitude toward most of the idea of the UFOs, the unidentified flying objects? I mean, they're all threats, aren't they? Really bad, you know, of course, because we're so good, you know? And the thing that Lewis always makes clear is, you know, we're the ones that are corrupt. It's very possible that all the rest of them aren't. But we have this absolutely smug idea that we've got it. One begins to surmise that the Aslan will finally not let the quarrels of Narnian life ever be resolved only by knowledge or by a blind obedience. Something distinctively appropriate to people and the animals like them is required. And this is the part I want you to pay attention to. So if you've been sleeping until now, please pay attention to this. It is as though Aslan teaches everybody a new zeal for the quality of his or her life, and that doing something with our lives involves knowledge, morals, imagination, and character. Furthermore, how those animals and children live and think determines what they love and finally even know. We get an odd and strange clue from a land of fantasy to the importance of the frame of life and mind within which some things become accessible to us. And it is as though Aslan teaches everybody a new zeal for the quality of his or her life, and that doing something with our lives involves knowledge, morals, imagination, and character. Now, that's really true. I think those of you who've read the Narnia books know that's true. And it's true of what, as you read Lewis's essays and enter into them, they give you the same kind of a real feeling of, wow, you know, life is a lot more than I've really given it credit for being. In brief, then, Lewis's literature shows us something without quite arguing about it. He would have it that literature actually creates thoughts in us. It is not only about thoughts, it causes them to exist. I think this is so primary that I guess I have to read it again. It is not only about thoughts, it causes them to exist. That is, if you pay attention to what Lewis is writing, you will be thinking about it yourself. But it's not just his writing he's talking about. This is true of all of good literature. And that means don't feel that you have to have read 150 books and say, why, look, oh yes, I've read that. Yes, I've read that. Yes, I've read that. Now that's no guarantee that anything has happened to you. My favorite professor, David Swenson, used to say, if you had one book and read it and asked questions about everything on each page, you'd have a complete education by the time you finished that book. Now, I think sometimes we think that the number of books is the important thing. And it isn't. It's the way in which we read the books that we read. The way we identify and get into them. The one thing about having a number of books around you is that you don't always hit the book that you identify with in quite, you know, there aren't, not all books are the same for every person. And so some books you may relate to and some you may not. But the important thing is that if you're going to read something that is, you know, acceptably valid as good literature, it, one of the checks of it is that it ought to create a real conscious thought process in your mind. Literature is not about existence so much as it is an addition to it. It gives us experiences, feelings, moral pangs, wishes, hopes that we have never had. And this is, I think, is true for all of us when we read, when we read something and enter into it, that we identify with it, we lose ourselves in it. And that's why people call literature sometimes escape, because we forget where we are. But in a sense, it's not an escape that's permanent, because when we come back from that trip, you know, we're carrying something with us again. Literature is not a disguised theory, nor an implied didacticism. Instead, it communicates in such a way that when successful, and this is, you know, Homer is really a good writer on in many respects. Sometimes some of the stuff in here, it's, the style is clumsy and rather scholarly in its terminology. But then you hit these wonderful, airy places that just give you a whole new breath, and this is one of them. When successful, literature creates new capabilities and capacities, powers, and a kind of roominess in the human personality. A kind of roominess in the human personality. And this is what it does. Carol wrote a poem a couple years ago called Brethren, Make Space in Your Hearts. And I think that this is what we need is a space in our personalities, in our hearts, so that we don't get so crunched up in just the way we think, a sort of a narrow little ditch, but that there is a willingness to listen and accept and move around in a wider room. Literature communicates in such a way that when successful, it creates new capabilities and capacities, powers, and a kind of roominess in the human personality. One becomes susceptible to new competencies, new functions, new pathos, and possibilities. New pathos. You get a new sensitivity to suffering. You get broadened. Maybe you've never lived in a slum. Maybe you've never lived in a palace. Maybe you've never lived here or there. I mean, maybe you've just lived in middle-class housing or less or high, depending on. I mean, All right, that doesn't matter. That's no offense to your imagination. No offense and no fence. I mean, your imagination doesn't have to have a fence on it. And it doesn't have to be sort of barriered in by your own particular local memory, because you've got all the ages to live in, and you can live in all the centuries. And that's why I believe in using the present tense when you talk about authors who wrote in the 4th century, very often we say Jesus says as well as Jesus said, and we say St. Paul writes as well as St. Paul wrote, because we live in the eternal present. We live in the eternal now. And if George MacDonald doesn't give anything but that's worth it, the holy carelessness of the eternal now. But also, it's true of your freehold in all of literature, in all of writing, that you are contemporary with all these writers. So that even if you don't live in the Middle Ages, Dante can speak to you. You don't have to know all about Florence. You can still read what he says and find that it strikes a responsive chord within you. The Christian literature does not merely propose a doctrine to be believed, nor a policy to be espoused. If that were the only way Christianity could be advanced among us, its appeal would be only to those who could think big ideas and entertain vast plans. Instead, Lewis addresses all of us where we are, faltering and stumbling, uncertain of what we should do or be. We are all open to a promise, poised for a great happiness, and already eligible for the sweeping away of the shadows of guilt and disappointment. Maybe our moral life, bumbling as it might have been, might have given us enough sorrow about ourselves to seek a way out. Maybe, too, we've hoped a little and discovered the vanity of much of our wishing. Christianity deepens those misgivings about ourselves into repentance, and that fitful expectation into an encompassing hope. I'm going to read that last sentence again. Christianity deepens those misgivings about ourselves into repentance. In other words, you know, our feeling of, you know, I really tried and, oh, and I failed again and I did a lousy job. That Christianity takes those kinds of experiences of ours, even if we didn't know that, you know, that it had anything to do with Christianity, so that it addresses the human condition. If Christianity didn't address the human condition, if you had to be a Christian before you were addressed by Christianity, what kind of a mishmash would the whole thing be? It would have nothing to do with the world. You would have to be trained into it. But because we believe, and Lewis, this is what hit Lewis so strongly, was that Christianity addresses the human condition, the human person as he is. And therefore, when he says, maybe our moral life might have given us enough sorrow about ourselves to seek a way out, we've hoped a little and discovered the vanity of much of our wishing. And then Homer says, Christianity deepens those misgivings about ourselves into repentance, and that fitful expectation into an encompassing hope. These things are again capabilities that have to be articulated and then strengthened in us. For Lewis, this is the way Christian literature, even Jesus' teaching and early discipleship, ought to work. So he does it. So Lewis does it. The novels bear the same point for all of us. There we see the psychomachia happening in others. We see this drama going on in other people. And when we see it going on in other people, then it does something to our own struggle in our own life. It makes our own lives dramatic to us. And critical literature never lets us forget how literature really ought to work in us. All of Lewis's work seems to have this common shape. Now, I'm not going to discuss his theories on literature, because I think it's, I think it's important, but, and I'm just going to read a couple of, just very briefly, a couple of the things that he uses in connection with his understanding of our relationship with good writing. But, you know, I think we could have a window open. Will it be too much of a draft on those of you who have colds? Maybe on this side. You know, you get sleepy around noon, and it's hard for some people to stay awake when it gets warm. We need to have, Homer says, and this is, he says, this is what Lewis comes across with, a texture of understanding that we gradually become acquainted with as we experience more and more in our living and live with attention and sagacity. And that this kind of experience is bound up very often in our exposure to good literature. He says, there is no substitute for a general wisdom and a tough health of mind. A tough health of mind. In poetry, one must know one's language exceedingly well and certainly have a wide experience of poetry. This is not knowledge in the conveyable and rather standardized sense. It is the kind we refer to when we say that a wise person is knowledgeable about human beings and human history. In other words, that you don't just know poetry by reading about it. Neither do you know poetry by just reading a poem and not knowing what the language of poetry really means. That you don't judge poetry on just a conversational level. You know, well, this poetry, I mean, then all you want to read is, what's his name, Rod? What's his name, that Rod Mc something? McEwen. I mean, you know, he really talks to me. Well, of course, I mean, that's perfectly all right if he talks to you, but don't call it poetry. You know, I mean, it's poetry of a sort, but that's not the kind of poetry that Lewis is speaking about. I mean, the kind of thing that he says you have to really learn the real words of poetry, what the rules of the game are in poetry. This requires some attention. It requires some work. But he also says that when you learn in terms of being wise, a person who has wisdom, he doesn't have wisdom, he is wise. That is, if you study people and you learn to know people, and you learn to know history, and you learn to know literature, you're not going to have a lot of facts that say, you know, I have so much wisdom in this and this and this, but you are a wise person. You see, this again is this whole understanding of reading and exposure so that you become the knower, you become consciously a participator in what you're reading. An unsuspected consequence of the reading of literature is that it enlarges that everyday capacity for explanation that we already command. By thinking and feeling with persons in literary contexts, not so much the authors themselves, but with the fictional characters, and by the help of the individual poetic lines, we extend pathos, passion, desire, wishes, and we become ideally more competent ourselves. Literature adds to reality. It does not simply describe it. It enriches the necessary competency that daily life requires and provides. And in this respect, it irrigates the deserts that our lives have already become. Now, you may not feel that your life is much of a desert yet because you're pretty young. But, on the other hand, there are times when you feel pretty barren, pretty low. And people very often say, well, don't, you know, literature is an escape or so on. But Lewis feels very strongly, and what Homer is explaining here, is that that literature can irrigate this. It can help you, you know, get some flow into that desert so that you begin to feel more intensely and deeply into life again, and you don't begin to just see, oh, how terrible it is for me and how bad, what a bad life I have. But you rather go on and move into another, you know, a better kind of viewpoint. I mean, perhaps it's not what we think about when we think about all of literature. We don't always think about it that way, that it's going to do that for us, and we don't read it with the idea of taking a little vitamin or medicine. But it is true that it does have that effect on us. And he has one little thing here about Till We Have Faces. How many of you have the book Till We Have Faces? It's quite a book. It's a hard book to read. It's not externally simple. Lewis combines Platonic myths and Greek myths with a Christian interpretation, and it's all kind of wrapped up in a very enigmatic kind of plot and style. And you have to do a little work with that book. So, you know, you may not decide to read it right yet. But someday, I would say it's a very good idea to read it. As Homer himself says, the novel is a taxing book to read, both because it requires such an imaginative effort and because it says things that are unfamiliar and which indict the reader when understanding dawns. Because the trouble is, that book actually speaks to our condition. It really does. And the very fact that it's harder to get makes it even more of a shock. It just, you know, you feel like you ought to get a reward for having finally figured it out, and then it hits you. That's always uncomfortable. Lewis's point is that he takes with great seriousness the picture of human potency and capacity. Any person is, in principle, capable of realizing what others have become, especially in matters of aesthetics, morals, attitude, passion, and even faith. Thus, there are exceedingly good people who seem to be morally discerning, even though they live in contexts that do not solicit the same. So, too, there are almost by nature Christian-like people who live in a pagan society. Can you think of a book that you may have read this year that is an example of that? Did you read Thornton Wilder's Woman of Andros? How many of you read that? Well, no. What about the Woman of Andros? Didn't she have some of these qualities of what we think of that are classically Christian qualities? Her real love for these down and outers that nobody was caring about at that time. And remember the book, the beginning and the end of the book, you know, the wonderful sort of Advent kind of a meditation that Wilder has in the introduction and the conclusion. And he says here that there is some of that in all of the background of human history. And God addresses these people too, because they're part of his creation. They're part of the world for whom Christ died. And you remember you can imagine that in the title, the very title of the book, Till We Have Faces, the meaning of the book is, of course, that the gods cannot meet human beings until we have faces, until we are. And just think about that when you think about yourself in terms of this whole consciousness business and this whole idea of paying attention to what you're doing, paying attention to what you're reading, paying attention to the to life and thought. It is that it's the development of your face that's going on. You know, you don't have a blank up here. When people look at you, you have a face, and that face is an expression of something. And you remember what Dante says about what we are, that we're the reflection of the splendor of God. You know, we reflect that splendor. The beetle reflects the splendor of God as a beetle, and the human being reflects the splendor of God as a human being. And that's what Jesus came to, you know, to kind of get through to us, is is to restore us to the splendor. And, I don't know. The woman who is the heroine of the book, Oriol, is not a symbol any more than are the animals in the Chronicles of Narnia. Instead, Lewis himself insists that she is an instance, a case, of human affection in its natural condition, true, tender suffering, but in the long run, tyrannically possessive. And then Homer goes on to say, her story stands on its own right. And this is why I began this whole discussion last week with the importance of the image. That the image is a story in its own right. It has a life of its own. And that its relationship to the greater image or the basis is one that we apply and discover for ourselves. But the image stands on its own feet and does its own thing. And this is also true in this novel. Her story stands on its own right. The better it is, and the less of the author there is in it, the sooner will one note, quote, the close parallel to what is probably happening at this moment in at least 5 families in your hometown. And this is the shocker of the book of Till We Have Faces, is that there is a really close parallel, not only with your own heart, but also that the story itself could be going on, you know, in your neighborhood. And then the important thing about discovering potentialities in oneself to achieve a kind of clarity, you acquire a face, even a character, that is firsthand. Now, when I talk about all these things as Lewis mentioned them and as Lewis discussed them and as Homer is developing them here, and when I talk about developing character, I hope you're not getting any mixed up ideas like character development or a kind of a Boy Scout approach to life or Masonic methods of all going to the same great architect of the universe and we just all are stumbling along and getting better and better. I mean, that's not what Lewis is referring to. What Lewis is talking about is that we have responsibilities as sons of God, that we are, and for the benefit of the tape, I will say that I use the term sons in terms of the totality of the human being. To continually haul daughters in as if we have to be defended. I consider myself a son of God. I don't care what anybody else thinks. So, that we have a responsibility in this direction. This is not something that you take lightly. And I think sometimes Protestants, in their concern about being saved by faith, certainly Lutherans, are so worried lest we be caught in the kind of a works righteousness thing, we really get worried about being conscious of ourselves at all. Now, I don't think for one minute that this isn't the kind of consciousness in which you say, "No, I'll try to be more honest today. I'm going to try to be kinder. I'm going to be sweeter, more patient. You know, add a whole bunch of virtues to yourself." And then at the end of the day, you check it off and say what you did and what you didn't do. And I'm about 3 degrees up the ladder and so on. That isn't, this isn't in it at all. This is a whole totality of being, that a whole style of life, if you please, that Lewis is speaking about, in which you are totally alert to all the possibilities and capacities that life has for you. Personally, when I really, and it took me a long time before Christ really got to me in terms of any kind of totality of reaching me. I was really I wasn't a hardened criminal, but I could just as well have been, as far as getting at me. Probably would have been easier. But I felt very much that all of a sudden, all the doors were being opened here and here and here and here. And would I ever have time to get through all those doors? Because the awareness of life became so multiple and so fascinating and so tremendous to me. And that's what I think is true of what Lewis is talking about, is these opportunities are so much there. It's an awareness of all these new vistas that come to you, and that you don't, from now on, you're going to live it first hand instead of derivatively. You're not going to live on what somebody else says. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and it must be true because I really respect that person. I mean, don't go by what somebody else says. You have to try it on for size for yourself. It may not be true for you yet, that word. You have to find out. And that's what Lewis is continually saying. You listen to what somebody teaches you, you pay attention to it, you write it down so you don't forget it, and then you begin to see, now, do I really know what that means myself? Well, this is a lifetime of work, you can see. It requires a lot of energy. And fortunately, none of us is so absolute that we take it all in the totality, so that otherwise we'd all be exhausted, not be able to manage. And the Lord, through the power of the Holy Spirit, gives us a sense of humor, and we realize we don't always make it. But it's important to be reminded. We turn to two related deliberations that are pertinent. We have to remember that a piece of literature is an object. It's something that you look at and that you read. As an object, it begins to create a new consciousness when properly read, of the world and oneself. In other words, this is what literature can be and what Lewis understands it to be. In fact, it gives us acquaintanceship with people and situations, not theories about them. Literature does that. It gets us used to people. It presents them as subjects and not as objects. To say that a piece of art or literature is an object is to say that it is objective about a mode of human subjectivity that its author may or may not share. The reader begins to share the life of the literature. He even has actual emotions and pathos as he reads. Now, this is something I want you to think about and see if you agree with. Bad literature describes emotions. Bad literature describes emotions. Good literature so presents situations and contexts that the appropriate emotions happen to the reader. Now, think back at some of the kind of fast reading you can do, you know, some of these kind of jazzy fast novels or sentimental things, or even science fiction that goes real fast. You know, the emotions are all described for you. You know, you don't have to enter into it. You can weep a little bit, but no, they're not real emotions. But good literature really produces a situation that you have, by the way in which that writer has written the background and written you into it, so that you are the subject of that book. So you're the one that's part of it now, and so that it happens to you. And here is where I thought again of Dorothy Sayers and her Tools of Learning, because her concern was with the fact that we've skipped the way in which people ought to be able to handle the tools of learning and given them just a lot of hit and miss materials, so that you cannot actually move from one block of ideas to another that may be different from each other, because you don't have the right tools that are flexible in both areas. And she speaks there, as I think I just mentioned the other day, of the importance of learning, for instance, rhetoric and logic, and understanding how to refute and how to discriminate in truth and propaganda, between truth and propaganda, how to be able to debate a subject, how to be able to see both sides of it and write them out, and so on. And Lewis says that as a person becomes a knower, Literature can materially aid any one of us to develop this. We can become knowers and we can be subjects who know. And in this context, then, knowing is not a matter of having a large store of facts or a panoply of laws at one's behest. Becoming a knower here supposes a readiness to see, a facility to size things up, and a quickness to understand. One becomes knowing and accommodating to the states of affairs, not simply well informed or erudite. One of the things that Lewis says that I think is really fun, and I remember it very clearly from the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. You remember Eustace, when he says, "In our world, a star is a huge ball of flaming gas," and he is told by a wiser head, "Even in your world, my son, that is not what a star is, but only what it is made of." Now that's a very, that's a child story. Stars may be made up of something, but can you say what they are? Well, Homer's section on what people are is a very good one, and I've talked a good deal about what his concern with people and why why Homer uses, for example, a whole chapter on this, what people are and their capabilities and their ability to become, their ability to pay attention, their ability to enter in, for instance, the very fact that we can enter into literature and into good writing and see what happens to us when we do. I wanted to read to you one of the chapter in here on, not the whole chapter, but this one section that where Lewis is writing about the fall, and he writes about the analysis of the sort of the psychology of Eve. And this is where I would like to mention the fact that, you see, even in something like this, A Preface to Paradise Lost, which you might say, well, that's, get into that. Well, it's really amazing what is in there and what it's like. It's like Dorothy Sayers' introduction to the Dante, to the cantos, and to the books of the comedy. I can't believe what it did for my reading, and not with the idea of its becoming derivative or dependent on Dorothy Sayers' interpretation, but simply allowing me to enter in a whole new way. In the introduction that Lewis makes to the little quotation that he uses at the beginning of this chapter on the fall is from Sir Arthur Eddington, who's a famous scientist, and wrote, and this is from The Nature of the Physical World, "If you take a pack of cards as it comes from the maker and shuffle it for a few minutes, all trace of the original systematic order disappears. The order will never come back however long you shuffle. Shuffling is the only thing which nature cannot undo." Have you ever thought about that? When you shuffle cards, you shuffle and shuffle and shuffle. They'll never come back right again. You have to sit down and put them all back together, don't you? Well, you see why you think Lewis used this as a quote for the beginning of this chapter on the fall. Eve fell through pride. The serpent tells her first that she's very beautiful, and then that all living things are gazing at her and adoring her. Next, he begins to make her feel herself impaired. Her beauty lacks spectators. What is one man? She ought to be adored and served by angels. She would be queen of heaven if all had their rights. God is trying to keep the human race down. Godhead is their true destiny. And Lewis has all these, with the line, and with the chapter and verse on it so that you know the exact specific reference. Godhead is their true destiny. And Godhead is what she thinks of when she eats. Now, you, I think it would be fun for you to, I should have brought brought Paradise Lost in with me just to read this. We've done it in the fall a lot with Dr. Morfitt, and I should really have brought it just because it's so, this is such a good analysis of it. The results of her fall begin at once. Now remember, do you remember what we said? Where did the temptation come? Remember, we talked about in Charles Williams yesterday, we talked about the body. Where was the temptation? Well, temptation to the body, senses, came the will and the spirit. You know? God's trying to keep the human race down. You really were meant to be a God. And Godhead is what she thinks of when she eats. The results of her fall begin at once. She thinks first that earth is a long way from heaven and God may not have seen her. The doom of nonsense is already at work. Next, she decides that she will not tell Adam about the fruit. She will exploit her secret to become his equal. Or no, better still, his superior. The rebel is already aiming at tyranny. But presently she remembers that the fruit may after all be deadly. She decides that if she is to die, Adam must die with her. It's intolerable that he should be happy. And happy, who knows, with another woman when she's gone. I'm not sure that critics always notice the precise sin which Eve is now committing. Yet there's no mystery about it. Its name in English is murder. If the fruit is to produce deity, Adam shall have none of it. She means to do a corner in divinity. But if it means death, then he must be made to eat it in order that he may die. For that reason and no other, as her words make perfectly plain. And hardly has she made this resolve before she is congratulating herself upon it as a singular proof of the tenderness and magnanimity of her love. And she does, you know, she rationalizes the whole thing. Well, no, I really am, this is just the only way to treat Adam fairly. Now, this is the little sort of capsule of how Lewis sizes up this whole temptation. If the precise movement of Eve's mind at this point is not always noticed, that is because Milton's truth to nature is here almost too great, and the reader is involved in the same illusion as Eve herself. Now, you see, the thing is that this is what I've been leading up to in all these discussions that Homer has been having on the way in which, if you are going to read the way Lewis wants you to read, you enter into this thing and you become a part of it. The trouble is, with anything as big as Paradise Lost, we read it as literature. You know, it's something, it's a classic. And it doesn't really have anything to do with us. And so we never think that what's being said is actually addressing our situation or our condition. And that's exactly what Lewis says. The whole thing is so quick. Each new element of folly, malice, and corruption enters so unobtrusively, so naturally, that it's hard to realize we've been watching the genesis of murder. We expect something more like Macbeth's "Unsex me here." But Lady Macbeth speaks thus after the intention of murder has already been fully formed in her mind. Milton is going closer to the actual moment of decision. Thus, and not otherwise, does the mind turn to embrace evil. No man perhaps ever at first described to himself the act he was about to do as murder or adultery or fraud or treachery or perversion. And when he hears it so described by other men, he is, in a way, sincerely shocked and surprised. Those others don't understand. If they knew what it had really been like for him, they would not use those crude stock names like murder and adultery and fraud. You know, she doesn't understand me, you know. My wife has just not understand me since she's had the children. You know, that's
One of the typical.
With a wink or a titter or in a cloud of muddy emotion, the thing has slipped into his will as something not very extraordinary, something of which, rightly understood, and in all his highly peculiar circumstances, he may even feel proud. Really did the right thing. He made a decision. He stood on his own feet. He decided, you know, I just have to do this. I'll take the responsibility. I'll have to kill her, or I have to leave my wife, you know. I really love this other woman. If you or I, reader, ever commit a great crime, be sure we shall feel very much more like Eve than like Iago in Othello. She has still a further descent to make. Before leaving the tree, she does low reverence before it as to the power that dwelt within, and thus completes the parallel between her fall and Satan's. She, who thought it beneath her dignity to bow to Adam or to God, now worships a vegetable. She has at last become a primitive, quote, in the popular sense. Another very good whole section in here on the way Adam fell. He fell by uxoriousness, in other words, by his doting on his wife. And it's also very good. But the wonderful thing, way in which Lewis describes this, I think, is an example for you of how good criticism can help you to enter into a great piece of writing. In other words, he doesn't talk a lot about, in this particular place, for instance, about how you should interpret it in terms of literarily or anything. This is really a real call to you to listen to this as an appeal to the human condition, that this literature is being addressed to you as a person. And I think when you read that, you realize this is remarkably clear, the way in which his kind of writing is great for this kind of experience for all of us. He has a very good conclusion in the preface to Paradise Lost that I thought we might close with, because although I haven't gone through all that I would like to have done with Lewis, I feel that that you're really, you don't need to have him explain to you so much as, you know, alerted to you again at the end of the year, because you started with him, and that you just kind of need to have your consciousness opened up again to his kind of salty truth and his very sharp kind of challenge. He's very concerned that we not take a kind of a stream of consciousness approach to the way in which we live. In other words, you kind of, like a dog, you kind of sniff along and follow wherever the smells are, and you know, and it's really neat, you know, to kind of, whatever happens to come to the top, that's where it's at, man, you know, that's where we are, and you know, it's really wonderful. He's really opposed to that. Just totally opposed to it, because Lewis feels that there is order, and there is a clarity in the universe, and we do have to submit ourselves to some of this sort of thing. The disorganized consciousness, which this kind of stream of consciousness regards as specially real, is in fact highly artificial. It is discovered by an introspection, that is, by artificially suspending all the normal and outgoing activities of the mind and then attending to what is left. In that residuum, it discovers no concentrated will, no logical thought, no morals, no stable sentiments, and in a word, no mental hierarchy. Of course not. For we have deliberately stopped all these things in order to introspect. The poet who finds by introspection that the soul is mere chaos, instead of, as Homer talks about, a real theater, a real Schauplatz where there are real struggles going on of good and evil and an attempt to one to gain the superiority over the other, that this is a real thing that's going on. Instead of this, the stream of consciousness approaches it sort of a chaotic, sort of a lovely, blissful, finger painting kind of a mess down there. That the soul is mere chaos is like a policeman. And Lewis is so choice in some of his illustrations, who, having himself stopped all the traffic in a certain street, should then solemnly write down in his notebook, and you can see these English bobbies, you know, the stillness in this street is highly suspicious. Well, you know, that's just about the way you are. If you look at your soul after you've, stopped all the externals from coming at you, and then you're going to just see what's down in there, and then, well, of course it's chaos. You've not allowed yourself to be under any kind of order. It can very easily be shown that the unselective chaos of images and momentary desires which introspection discovers is not the essential characteristic of consciousness. For consciousness is, from the outset, selective and ceases when selection ceases. You see, consciousness is not kind of a feeling thing, you know. Well, I just, you know, I really feel a lot about this now. I think that's what consciousness is. The word itself, conscire, in Latin, means to know with, in connection with, to know about something that has to do with, particularly, usually, the with is connection with the self. But you know it in a real concrete sense, not in a kind of a, not a, an emotional, just an emotional sense, but it's a real knowledge kind of thing as well. And, yes, and ceases when selection ceases. Lewis has in his Studies in Words a good chapter on conscious and conscience. A good analysis of this. Now, this may be a little more, you know, academic than you want to go into. I think you can get it out of the library sometime and look at it. I'm not going to sell all the books Meredith has in the bookstore. But for any of you who happen to be interested in linguistics, this is a fascinating book. Really, really good. Not to prefer one datum before another, not to attend to one part of our experience at the expense of the rest, is to be asleep. The process of waking, and after that of coming fully awake, consists in bringing selected elements into focus. When the voice of your friend, or your teacher, or the page of your book sinks into democratic equality with the pattern of the wallpaper or the color of of the picture on your wall, the feel of your clothes, your memory of last night and the noises of the road, you're falling asleep. The highly selective consciousness enjoyed by fully alert men with all its builded sentiments and consecrated ideals has as much claim to be called real as the drowsy chaos of the stream of consciousness school, and more. That this chaos may furnish hints for a psychologist's diagnosis, I do not deny. But to conclude thence that in it we reach the reality of the mind is like thinking that the readings of a clinical thermometer give us a specially real view of the body or a picture in a medical textbook. And even if it were granted, which I do not grant, that the unfocused or unelaborated consciousness were in itself specially real, it would still remain true that literature, which claims to represent it, is specially unreal. In other words, he is, of course, really taking off on Ulysses, on James Joyce's Ulysses, because he says, what's the idea of writing that kind of of what he considers pure gimmickry. Well, I think James Joyce had a plan in it, and certainly in Finnegan's Wake, he you know, if you kind of get some of the riddles and the symbols in it, you can understand it. But Lewis says that's not the way to write. You don't celebrate chaos. You celebrate order. You celebrate clarity. You celebrate light, not the darkness of the sort of the subconscious mix-ups. And he says, even if it were granted, I still don't think you should read about it. You better just be satisfied with what you've got, but don't think that you're going to be any better off because you're reading somebody else's. That doesn't make you an authentic chaos. You've got to be your own authentic chaos and let it go at that. And I guess I'd have to kind of agree with that. For the very nature of such unfocused consciousness is that it is not attended to. Inattention makes it what it is. The moment you put it into words, you falsify it. It is like trying to see what a thing looks like when you are not looking at it. You cannot make a true picture of that no man's land between the visible and the invisible, which exists on the edges of our field of vision, because just insofar as you make a picture, you're bringing it into the center. I do not say that it may not be fun to try. There may be a place for literature which tries to exhibit what we're doing when will and reason and attention and organized imagination are all off duty and sleep has not yet supervened. But I believe that if we regard such literature as specially realistic, we are falling into illusion. And he feels very specifically that the very things that he mentions in that sentence are the things that we have to pay attention to in all of our reading and as we enter into literature, that will and reason and attention and organized imagination, they can't be off duty, they can't be asleep if we think that we're going to read or write literature. They have to be alert and aware, and that's where we're at when we're living lives that are really in focus.